BBC World Service, welcome to World Briefing with Fiona MacDonald. The headlines at 7 GMT. A US judge has approved an agreement forcing the Microsoft Corporation to reveal details of its software systems in order to increase competition. The acquittal of the butler to the late Diana, Princess of Wales, following an intervention by the Queen, has raised questions about the decision to go forward with a prosecution for theft. A judge in Colombia has ordered two brothers, described by the United States as the world's biggest drug traffickers, to be released from prison. And coming up later in sport, Andre Agassi's hopes of ending the year as the tennis world number one have suffered a setback with defeat at the Masters Series event in Paris. This is the BBC in London. First, we'll have the details on those top stories.
BBC News with Zainab Ahmed. A federal judge in the United States has approved most of the provisions of an anti-monopoly settlement between Microsoft Corporation and America's Department of Justice. The agreement requires Microsoft to reveal software secrets to competitors so they can produce alternative systems for computers. The Attorney General, John Ashcroft, said the judgment restored competitive conditions in the software industry. Bill Gates, head of Microsoft, said the company is pleased with the final outcome of the case.
This settlement puts new responsibilities on Microsoft, and we accept them. We recognize that we will be closely scrutinized by the government and our competitors, and we will devote the time, energy, and resources needed to meet these new rules.
Nearly 3 years ago, a trial court found that Microsoft used its dominance over rivals to maintain an illegal market monopoly. This ruling is intended to allow other companies to compete more effectively in the computer software market. The collapse of the trial in London of the butler to the late Princess Diana has shocked leading royal and legal commentators. The butler, Paul Burrell, was cleared of stealing personal items belonging to the princess, found during a police raid on his home. The case fell apart after it was revealed that Queen Elizabeth said she recalled the butler telling her that he was holding some of Diana's personal effects for safekeeping. Peter Hunt reports.
Paul Burrell is now at an undisclosed location with his family, recuperating after the turmoil of the past 2 years. The collapse of his trial has left some nagging questions. Why did details of this crucial meeting between the sovereign and her servant not emerge earlier? Courtiers say the Queen hadn't been briefed about the trial, and it was only when she told Prince Charles that alarm bells began to ring. Even more perplexing is the suggestion Paul Burrell was prepared to contemplate a prison term rather than disclose what he'd said to the Queen. Officials have insisted there's been no regal interference in the legal process. But the Queen's actions have stopped any more damaging disclosures about life behind palace walls.
Police in Indian-administered Kashmir say two rifle grenades have been fired at the home of Mufti Mohammed Saeed just hours before he was due to be sworn in as the new chief minister. Family members say no one was hurt in the attack in a suburb outside Srinagar. The authorities say they believe Islamic militants were responsible for the attack. You're listening to the news from the BBC. A judge in Colombia has ordered the release of two of the country's most notorious criminals, once named by the United States government as the world's biggest drug traffickers. The two men, who were brothers, were jailed in 1995 for running the Cali cocaine cartel, which shipped tons of cocaine to the United States and Europe. The Colombian government is trying to overturn the ruling. Jeremy McDermott reports from Colombia.
Judge Pedro Jose Suarez ordered the release of Miguel and Gilberto Rodriguez Orejuelo, saying that they were eligible having served three-fifths of their sentence with good behavior. The announcement took hardline President Alvaro Uribe by surprise. He ordered a top-level investigation into the matter and demanded that Judge Suarez be investigated and that the director of the prison where the drugs barons are being held, who recommended their release, be suspended. The notoriously direct Interior Minister, Fernando Londoño, said he believed the immense financial power of the drug barons had corrupted the justice system and that this showed it was not up to the task of taking on drugs traffickers and that they should be all extradited to the United States.
Police in the United States have linked another shooting to the recent series of sniper killings in the Washington area. The attack took place in mid-September when a 22-year-old man was shot outside a shop in Maryland. Police say the man survived the shooting and is now recuperating. A former soldier, John Allen Muhammad, and his 17-year-old companion, John Lee Malvo, have been detained in connection with the sniper attacks. Residents of the Italian village of San Giuliano have spent a second night outside following an earthquake which killed 26 children and three adults. A strong tremor, almost as strong as the first earthquake on Thursday, shook the village on Friday, sending terrified residents into the streets. Italian authorities have ordered the evacuation of the hilltop village and set up tents in the valley below. Some 3,000 people in the surrounding region, northeast of Naples, were left homeless by the earthquake. BBC News.
It's 6 minutes past seven GMT. You're listening to World Briefing from the BBC in London with Fiona MacDonald. After several years of wrangling in and out of court, an American judge has approved a deal between the software company Microsoft and the US government. Microsoft had already been found guilty of abusing its monopoly by making it very hard for consumers to choose non-Microsoft products. The latest judgment imposes no financial penalty, but it forces the software giant to disclose some technical information, enabling rivals to compete. The US Attorney General John Ashcroft welcomed the decision and said it would provide stability in a sector vital to America's economy.
This settlement resolved the antitrust case claims brought against Microsoft nearly 4.5 years ago, and resolved them in a manner that serves the interests of consumers, competition in the technology sector, and justice.
The judge said the sanctions against Microsoft are likely to last at least 5 years. Our North America business correspondent, Stephen Evans, examines the significance of the judge's decision.
9 out of 10 of the world's computers operate on Microsoft systems. The judgment means that it will be easier to choose non-Microsoft products rather than be bound to the whole Microsoft range when you buy a computer. The company will have to share some of its secret software with rivals so they can make compatible products. It will be easier for users to uninstall Microsoft products and choose alternatives. There are some legal hurdles left, but the essentials of the final settlement are there. The judgment gives some extra choice to consumers while not seriously hurting Microsoft. Whatever happens in the courts, its dominance will continue, rivals biting at its heels rather than destroying it.
Stephen Evans in New York. The US Vice President Dick Cheney has issued another blunt warning to the Iraqi leader. Mr. Cheney said Saddam Hussein must give up his weapons of mass destruction, or, as the Vice President put it, for the sake of peace, the US will disarm him. The Vice President was speaking to Republican Party supporters at an election rally for Senator Wayne Allard in the city of Denver. He was there to lend his support to the incumbent senator, who's facing a strong Democratic challenge in Tuesday's election that could determine which party controls the US Senate. Our correspondent Jonathan Marcus was at the rally.
Iraq and its weapons of mass destruction have not figured prominently in this midterm election campaign. It's the economy, housing, healthcare, and a range of domestic issues that are uppermost in voters' minds. Nonetheless, Vice President Dick Cheney used this rally in the key state of Colorado to repeat the Bush administration's tough line on Iraq in uncompromising terms. He said that wars were not won on the defensive and that America had to preempt serious threats before they materialized.
Saddam Hussein harbors terrorists and the instruments of terror. He is pressing forward with weapons of mass destruction and has already used them against the Iranians and against his own people. The government of the United States will not look the other way as threats gather against the American people.
Stressing the long-term nature of the battle against terrorism, Mr. Cheney noted that America was still closer to the beginning of this conflict than to its end. On the domestic front, the Vice President put forward a strong defense of the Bush administration's tax cuts, insisting that jobs could only be created when Americans were able to keep more of the money they earned. And he described the current Democratic leadership of the Senate as dysfunctional. The message went down well in a hall full of Republican true believers. But the real political battle here in Colorado is too close to call. Republicans and Democrats are running neck and neck. Every vote is going to count. Turnout will determine which party wins this contest. And the party that wins here in Colorado could well control the Senate itself.
Jonathan Marcus on the campaign trail in Denver, Colorado. The Convention on Trade in Endangered Species, known as CITES, meets in Santiago, Chile this weekend, where it will consider once again calls for an end to the ban on ivory trading. Five southern African countries with elephant populations are reported to have agreed a plan to reopen a limited trade. But as our correspondent Peter Grester reports from Santiago, Kenya believes the proposal is a huge mistake.
Depending on who you talk to, the plan to start selling African ivory is either one of the best ways to save the elephant or to condemn it to extinction. Now, though, it seems that a large chunk of African states has agreed to back a plan to reopen a limited and strictly controlled ivory trade. They've been meeting in Santiago ahead of the CITES conference, which opens on Sunday. Under the plan, five African countries will make a one-off sale in 18 months of stockpiled ivory, taken mainly from animals that died naturally, and provided a system for monitoring elephant populations is up and running by then. After that, there will be an ongoing annual trade, again, only in ivory taken from dead or rogue elephants. Why waste a valuable resource, they say, when the money could be used to protect elephants? The idea for the meeting of African states was to present a united proposal to avoid some of the angry exchanges that have disrupted CITES conferences in the past, but it may not have worked. Kenya has already registered its opposition and it's backed by India. Both want the ivory trade banned altogether. They've got some environmental heavyweights on side. That's because they believe that any legal sale of ivory simply opens an insatiable market that will ultimately be met by uncontrolled poaching. The CITES conference still has to vote on the proposal and it needs a two-thirds majority of its 160 members before it passes. But with an all but united African front, ivory may well be back on the market.
Peter Grester. You're listening to the BBC in London. In a moment, musicians returning to Afghanistan say they're being persecuted by fundamentalists, determined to continue the ban on music introduced by the Taliban. But first, today's main news. A US judge has approved an agreement forcing Microsoft to reveal details of its computer software systems in order to increase competition. The acquittal of the butler to the late Diana, Princess of Wales, has raised questions about the decision to go forward with a prosecution for theft. The acquittal came after an intervention by the Queen. And the latest round of United Nations climate change negotiations in Delhi have ended with an agreement focusing on the needs of developing countries. After a series of sometimes acrimonious debates, the final declaration emphasises that poorer countries are particularly vulnerable to global warming and calls for action from the West to help protect them. The Indian Environment Minister, who chaired the conference, said the declaration provides a new direction in efforts to tackle climate change. But environmental groups said that oil interests had prevented meaningful progress. Richard Black reports.
This was the first set of UN climate talks to be held in a major developing nation, and it's ended with a declaration heavy on the needs and the rights of the developing world. Poorer countries with fewer resources will suffer most from global warming, it says, and richer nations should help them adapt. Yet developing nations should not be obliged to restrain their own greenhouse gas emissions because that would harm their economic progress. Industrialised nations had argued that with the Kyoto Protocol likely to come into force early next year, the Delhi meeting was an opportunity to look beyond Kyoto and start discussing the tougher emissions cuts which all nations will have to make in future if the worst consequences of global warming are to be averted. At times, it's been a fiery and bad-tempered meeting. Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace both accused the United States and Saudi Arabia of driving a wedge between industrialised and developing countries. The Indian government was also accused of seeking US approval by drawing up an initial draft agreement even blander than the final version.
Richard Black. The biggest United Nations peacekeeping force in the world, based in the West African state of Sierra Leone, has begun a phased withdrawal from the country. The almost 18,000 troops played an important role in ending the nation's 10-year civil war. It will be another 2 years before the withdrawal is complete. But as Tom McKinley reports, the fact that it's begun at all is a significant step for Sierra Leone.
600 Blue Beret UN soldiers have been gathering at Sierra Leone's international airport over the last week in preparation to leave the country for good. This is a relatively small withdrawal. Almost 17,000 UN troops will remain in Sierra Leone, although that number will decrease gradually. But it is symbolic of a United Nations success in Sierra Leone. Peace was declared in January this year, 2 years after the UN arrived. And since then, the RUF rebels have been disbanded, the army has been retrained, and democratic elections have been held. Lieutenant General Apande, the United Nations Force Commander, says that Sierra Leone's peace represents a job well done.
I think it is a success story. Our aims, objectives, you know, have been attained, and that is why we have now reached a stage whereby we are drawing down.
But at the same time, he recognizes that the current peace is still fragile. Thousands of people are still displaced, ex-combatants remain unemployed, and corruption, the root cause of the war, is still rife. Sierra Leone is also under threat from neighboring Liberia's war, and an upsurge of fighting there could easily destabilize the entire region. In such an atmosphere, the UN withdrawal will be gradual.
As long as we remain here, we have the capability to deal with any eventualities, so we have plans.
This week's withdrawal represents the international community's newfound faith in Sierra Leone's ability to look after itself.
Tom McKinley. With the fall of the Taliban in Afghanistan and the appointment of Hamid Karzai as the country's interim leader, a number of key changes have been implemented. Women have returned to work, draconian religious rulings governing daily life have been scrapped, and many have returned from exile. However, a number of returning musicians say fundamentalists are still determined to continue the ban on music instigated by the former regime. The BBC's Kabul correspondent Kylie Morris has this report.
A wedding party in full swing in the Afghan capital, Kabul. This party in the garden on a cool autumn evening marks the end of a week-long celebration. And this is the highlight. Six musicians crowded onto a stage while male partygoers take to the carpeted dance floor one by one. The women look on from a neighbouring rooftop. Occasionally, men dance to the front and throw cash over the heads of the band members. It's going to be a profitable night. This kind of a wedding party was unthinkable under the Taliban when music was banned. Most of Afghanistan's musicians fled to the refugee camps of Pakistan, but many have now returned, anxious to keep alive their country's musical traditions. Some, though, are now thinking they returned too soon. Ustad Ghulam Hussein, an exponent of the Rabab, explains why.
I lived in exile for 12 years, but came back hopeful that peace meant we could go home. But there are still cases outside of Kabul of people trying to beat us and throwing grenades at our performances. I'm a musician, not a politician. There are some people who are opposed to the government who don't like music, but they must realize that a country without music or culture is nothing.
The harmonium player at this party was badly beaten and locked up by a local security commander when he played at a wedding on the Shimali Plain outside of Kabul. Mazrur and another musician were beaten throughout the night by the commander and his soldiers, who told them that music is banned there.
We feel the danger. We are trying not to go outside the Kabul area.
And does he think that ordinary Afghans want musicians to come back, or is it still too soon after the Taliban?
Yes, I think majority of the Afghans want to see their culture, tradition and history back, and they want to see the Afghan music coming back again.
Whether Afghans across the country get their music back again depends in large part on stability and peace extending beyond the capital. Only then will there be the harmony so many hope for.
Kylie Morris in the Afghan capital, Kabul. You're listening to the BBC in London. It's almost 7:20 GMT, and a reminder of the main news. A federal judge in the United States has approved an agreement forcing the Microsoft Corporation to reveal details of its software systems in order to increase competition. The acquittal of the butler to the late Diana, Princess of Wales, following an intervention by the Queen, has raised questions about the decision to go forward with a prosecution for theft. Sports news now. Over to the sports desk and Glenn Hicks.
Coming up in this roundup of world sport, Andre Agassi loses the match and his temper in Paris. Sir Alex Ferguson questions Arsenal's Premiership title hopes and will go live to the Rally of Australia. Thailand's Paradorn Shishapan is into the semi-final of the Paris Masters Tennis after beating Andy Roddick of the United States 6-3, 7-6. He joins world number one Leighton Hewitt, third seed Marat Safin and Spaniard Carlos Moya in the last four. Moya beats second seed Andre Agassi in straight sets. Here's our tennis correspondent Ian Carter.
Shishapan's victory over Andy Roddick effectively settled the lineup for the season-ending Masters Cup in Shanghai. It meant that Roddick couldn't overtake Jiří Novák, who gains the last qualification place. Shishapan won two tiebreaks in a hard-hitting contest that bodes well for the future, and the only shame is that neither player will be in Shanghai. There, Leighton Hewitt is firm favourite to win the champions race for the second year running. Having beaten Roger Federer in straight sets, the Australian top seed now faces Shishapan for a place in the final, while Carlos Moya's win over Andre Agassi ensured Moya would be one of three Spaniards in the Shanghai field. It also severely damaged Agassi's chances of overhauling Hewitt's lead in the race. Moya, meanwhile, plays Marat Safin in the semi-finals here.
So Agassi is out, but his exit was controversial. The American labelled umpire Cedric Mourier pathetic, furious with a number of overrules in favour of the Spaniard. And Moya admits it was difficult to maintain his concentration.
Every time he was complaining and he got all the support from the crowd, and that was tough, but I just tried to be focused, to be concentrated on myself and forget about everything, and that's what I did, and it really worked out very well.
The final of the Fed Cup begins on Saturday on the Spanish island of Gran Canaria, with the hosts facing Slovakia. Spain are aiming to win the title for the sixth time. Looking ahead, here's Richard Fleming.
Since winning it for the first time in 1991 with a shock defeat of the United States, Spain has been the most successful nation in the event, compiling four more victories and finishing as runners-up on four occasions. That success has been largely due to the exploits of Arantxa Sánchez Vicario and Conchita Martínez, both 30 years old, who'll set new records again this weekend. Sánchez Vicario already holds the record number of Fed Cup match wins at 72 and will break Virginia Wade's record of 57 Fed Cup ties played when she takes to the court against world number 9 Daniela Handzukova on Saturday. Not only will she also become the first player ever to contest 100 matches in Fed Cup, but both she and Martinez will be playing in their 10th final, surpassing the mark they previously shared with Americans Billie Jean King and Chris Evert. Martinez opens proceedings on Saturday with a match against Jeanette Husarova.
Now cricket, and Michael Vaughan and Andrew Flintoff have kept alive their hopes of playing in the first Ashes test after they were passed fit for England's final three-day warm-up match against Queensland, which is underway. Queensland won the toss in Brisbane, elected to bat, and then tucked into the England bowling to reach 333 for four by stumps on the opening day. Martin Love scored an unbeaten 124. West Indies have been enjoying the upper hand in the third and final test match against India in Calcutta. On day four, the tourists made 497 in their first innings for a lead of 139. Shivnarine Chanderpaul made 140 and Marlon Samuels 104. In their second innings, India are 77 for three. Hopes of a resolution in New Zealand cricket's pay strike dissolved when Players Association spokesman Rob Nicol labelled a final offer from administrators as cowardly. The players' demand is for a 60% increase, but New Zealand cricket's latest offer is just over 5%. If the players don't budge, then NZC will attempt individual contracts for the best possible team to play India in the first test, starting at Wellington's Basin Reserve on December the 12th. Now on to football, and the English Premiership features just four games on Saturday as those clubs that played in the UEFA Cup get an extra day's rest. Liverpool will expect to extend their lead at home to West Ham. Fourth place Manchester United are also at home against Southampton. Ahead of that game, the United manager, Sir Alex Ferguson, has had a subtle dig at Arsenal, who have now lost four games in a row for the first time in 19 years. Arsenal's manager Arsene Wenger famously suggested his side could go through the season unbeaten. But Sir Alex says that on current form, they're no longer title contenders.
Liverpool are now 4 points clear of Arsenal. Yeah. So for most of the season and for the last half of last season, Arsenal have been looking down from an ivory tower and talking very confidently. Now they're 4 points behind Liverpool, and I think that makes an impact in the league. I think we'll have to start looking at Liverpool and not Arsenal.
Also on Saturday, West Bromwich Albion are at home to Manchester City, and Birmingham City host Bolton. Arsenal will seek to end their losing streak on Sunday at Fulham. In Scotland, Rangers will go 4 points clear in the Premier League if they win at Dundee. Second-place Celtic play Aberdeen on Sunday. Well, there are two outstanding fixtures across continental Europe this weekend. In Spain, Real Madrid will need to be in good shape if they're to end their miserable run when they face Deportivo La Coruña, while the German league leaders Bayern Munich go to Werder Bremen. Meanwhile, in Italy, a minute's silence will be held before all Serie A games as a mark of respect for those who died in the earthquake which hit the south of the country. Looking ahead to the top games, here's Martin Fuchs.
The answer to the question, is it possible to lose with a team containing Ronaldo, Zidane, Figo, Raul and Roberto Carlos, is yes. It happened to Real Madrid at home to Roma in the Champions League this week. In fact, Real have won only one of their last seven matches at home and abroad. With three of the Madrid club's stars doubtful for Saturday night's match at La Coruña, plus the fact they haven't won there for 10 years, Deportivo have some cause for optimism. But talk of a crisis at Real Madrid is a touch premature. Real Sociedad are on top of the Spanish league by 3 points. They're away to Villarreal on Sunday. After their exit from Europe, Bayern Munich can concentrate on regaining their Bundesliga title from Borussia Dortmund. 3 points separate the pair at the top, with leaders Bayern away to Werder Bremen on Sunday, while Dortmund entertain Hamburg 24 hours earlier. There's also a 3-point gap between the two Milan clubs in Serie A, and that's not likely to change on Sunday. Leaders Inter are away to Como, AC Milan host Regina. Juventus, lying third, visit Modena. In France, the leaders Auxerre are away to Lens, but the most intriguing match looks like the champions Lyon at home to a much-improved Nice, who've lost only once away this season.
On to motorsport, and Marcus Gronholm looks untouchable in his Peugeot in the Rally of Australia. To get the very latest on happenings on day two, we can go live to Greg Strange at the service park at Chidlow, northeast of Perth.
Yes, 15 stages now complete, 5 more to come today, 4 more tomorrow, as we move into the mid-afternoon here in Western Australia. The main headline today, the retirement of Colin McRae, his Ford Focus, landing heavily after a jump. The sump guard smashed into the radiator, the coolant was lost, and that was that. He could not get through the next 2 stages without any coolant, so good night. And McRae joins Richard Burns in retirement. Marcus Gronholm continues to lead. We're waiting for his times from stage 16, but at stage 15, he was 32.2 seconds ahead of Subaru's Petter Solberg. His Peugeot teammate, Gronholm's Peugeot teammate that is, Harry Rovanperä, in third place, 48.3 behind. Carlos Sainz in fourth, 59.5. So 9 more stages after this, and some more details coming in on Daniel Grataloup, who received multiple fractures in a huge crash yesterday. The Mitsubishi co-driver is up and about, well, not up and about, but laughing and joking anyway with nurses in the hospital in Perth, and they hope to move him out of intensive care later today.
Now, before we go, a reminder of our main story. Spain's Carlos Moya has beaten second seed Andre Agassi in the quarterfinals of the Paris Masters tennis. The result is a serious blow to Agassi's hopes of ending the season as world number one, a position currently held by Australia's Leighton Hewitt. And that's all from this roundup of World Sport.
Thank you to Glenn Hicks. And a reminder of today's main world news, a federal judge in the United States has ruled that the world's largest software company, Microsoft, must reveal sensitive technical information as part of an antitrust settlement with the government. I'm Fiona MacDonald, and you're listening to the BBC in London.